You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
What is up, everybody? Welcome to Comic Book Club. I'm Alex.
I'm Justin.
I'm Pete.
And we're coming to you live from a couple of places on the internet. We are live on Facebook, YouTube, Twitch, Instagram, Kick. Maybe you're listening later wherever you get your podcast. If so, you can get ad-free versions of this podcast and all the podcasts that we do at patreon.com/comicbookclub. Come on down. We love to have you. And we got to start out. We got to talk about this. We have two great guests for you this evening.
Yeah,
we do. But we also have two great shirts for you this evening.
Oh, two and only two. There's the same one that Pete and I are wearing, and then Alex is wearing like an old Henley.
Yeah. I mean, come on.
Pete and I have officially
synced up. You're just going by JT? Now what happened to the Sizz?
What? So what is this? Is this a Felix the Cat shirt, or what's going on?
This is a Felix the Cat shirt that Pete and I got in New York Comic Con. At New York Comic Con. I'm trying to show the 2012 logo.
Alex, Pete, which you remember, that was a big con for us.
Yes.
Yes, but why specifically are you...
Well, we got these shirts there, Alex.
Yeah.
Oh, right. I remember.
It's huge.
It's huge.
We've been able to sync up our clothing.
Mm-hmm. And I do want to mention this reminded me about a little bit of an off thing that came up a couple of weeks back on the show. No, it's off of this, but like it has to do with the two of you being really synced up. Somebody had asked what the anniversary of you getting Jedi married live on the show is. This is a
January 4th.
Back in the day.
January 4th.
Yeah.
We celebrate it every year, Alex.
Why is that funny to you, Alex?
What's funny about that?
You don't think I remember our wedding anniversary?
You're a couple of gifts late on the anniversary.
Yeah,
I don't know why I didn't think about it. Obviously, both of you knew and before five minutes ago.
You didn't tell us beforehand. We knew in our brains. We're the same.
Is that how comedy works? You explain the joke after?
And sorry, real quick, what anniversary was it this year? What year?
Of our marriage?
Yeah, of your marriage.
Fair question.
Eight.
Eight is not correct. It's more than that. It's got to be more than that. Is it a special 10? Are we hitting 10? 12.
Yes, it's 10. 12. Time flies when you're Jedi married.
Here's the thing.
13.
We're sort of
13. 13. It was 13 back in January. You got married January 4th, 2012 is the date.
2012, Alex!
What a year! What a year!
Alex, it was Alan.
Now, you got Jedi married? You got shirts? Crazy year.
Crazy.
We
should get to our amazing guests, though.
We should get to our amazing guests and move beyond this. We'll find out if they have shirts as well, I guess. We'll see what happens.
If they're wearing the same shirt we're wearing, that's going to be something.
That would be crazy.
Wait a second. Who's that in the background? You got some Jedi explaining to do there.
Uh-oh. No, she's my sister. That's our sister.
Oh, okay. All right,
it's
cool. Yeah.
Oh, you cut off whatever she was saying. Interesting. All right,
yes, I definitely did that.
Why don't we bring in our first guest here? He is the creator behind The Last Witch, which is coming back for a sequel series at Boombox on June 18th. Ladies and gentlemen, Connor McCreary. Connor,
hey, welcome.
Hello.
How are you? Yeah, let's get it. Let's get it.
Bearded hooligan shirt.
Bearded hooligan.
I actually have a Felix the Cat t-shirt, and I didn't bring it with me. Really
you hastily tried to get it on, but there wasn't enough
and
time.
Pete and Jay, I also have to apologize because I know the 13th Jedi wedding is the Kyber Crystal.
It's a big one.
Right? It's the Kyber Crystal wedding, and the gift is in the mail. It is on the way. It's just
thank you so much.
Postal strikes. It's... But yeah, it's such a special, you know, 13. I mean,
13.
I'm just proud that I'm getting to be here to talk about this event that happened months ago.
Months ago, and also years ago, and also questionably real, but great.
But memories are a time machine.
That's
right. Oh, wow, that's deep, man. I love it. You should have spoke at our Jedi wedding.
Yes. Well, why don't we talk about this book a little bit, if you guys don't.
That's why it sounds so familiar.
The Last Witch, love this book. This is about a kid named Saoirse. That's how you pronounce it, right? I believe.
Saoirse.
Who, in sort of like a riff on Hansel and Gretel, decided she was going to kill all witches, but... spoilers for the series that preceded the one that we're going to talk about. Turns out she's kind of something of a witch herself. And that is something that she's going to have to grapple with going into this new series, Blood and Betrayal. I think one of the things that we really loved about this book was just the beautiful fairy tale nature of it, mixed with sort of not modern action tropes, but like a very propulsive pace to it at the same time, some big action scenes throughout, and some great character dynamics as well. So that's all the setup for the first series, which we liked. What can people expect in the sequel series, Connor?
Oh, well, first of all, thank you very much. Flatter me more. So, no, I mean, I guess I'll do a really quick summary of the first series, just in, you know, in case anybody's out there isn't familiar. I don't want to kind of confuse people. So like you said, it's about this 12-year-old girl who discovers that she can use magic, you know, yay.
Yeah.
After a coven of witches destroys her village, killing everybody except her, her bratty little brother, and her cigar smoking grandmother. Oh, and yes. You know, I like to kind of pitch it as sort of like Irish Avatar, The Last Airbender.
Oh,
just the right amount of child cannibalism. You know, like, if witches don't eat kids, then how do you know they're witches? Like, they might just be Estonian or something, right? Like, you know, that's
good point.
Oh, thank you.
It's crazy how much child cannibalism we had in our lives for a time.
I know,
like,
right?
That was a wild part.
Growing up in days of yawn, when, you know, children were just fed to people in every TV show that you could watch, right? Secret of Nimue. So for me, like, so basically book two picks up basically right after book one ends off. And one of the big questions about book one, the structure is Saoirse and her little brother Brom and her grandmother Nan have to go and track down this coven of witches to defeat them. But in the world of The Last Witch, the magic is not really for humans. It sort of has leaked into our world from the Irish folk, the Irish fairy lands. And so every time Saoirse learns more magic, every time she gains a new power and is able to defeat one of these witches, getting her closer to saving all of us, she's also getting closer from losing what makes her her and starting to become one of them. Becoming a witch herself, like you were saying, Alex. So at the end of book one, we have a moment, something significant has happened to somebody that Saoirse loves, and it's kind of pushed her to the edge. In a weird way, book two is sort of like almost like a Breaking Bad kind of journey. Because the big question for Saoirse, and you can see her here, she has this kind of strange birthmark. It has been spreading and growing across her body. It's starting to crawl up onto her neck and onto her face. And it is a representation of how much the power has grown in her, but how much she is starting to lose control. And so the very first issue of book two is, it starts with kind of a happy moment, right? Like they've gone through all these battles. Her little brother has had something horrible happen to him. And we have this moment where the two of them are just playing. They're just having fun. They're getting to be brother and sister and kids for the first time since the book began. But because of what's going on, things twist very quickly. And they run into a new group of witches that Saoirse has no idea exists. And this group of witches tells Saoirse that everything she knows about magic and how she's supposed to be using it is wrong. And it pushes her to a bad place. And we start to see how easy it is for Saoirse to fall into the trap of the anger and the rage that fuels this power. We were joking a little bit about Jedis. There is sort of, you know, one of the influences of this would be that idea of the dark side of when you have power, if you use it from a place of anger, hatred, frustration, that's going to have a very different effect than if you're using the power in a way where you are calm, where you are zen, where you are, you know, mindful of it. And so, yeah, so that's kind of the very first issue is going to really drive that home for the reader while setting up this next battle with one of this coven of witches. And so overall, I mean, the overall tone of the story is meant to be something that is supposed to be a little bit like something like The Secret of Nim or The Dark Crystal.
Yeah,
I wanted it to be kind of scary enough and intense enough that a younger reader would sit there and be like, oh man, like, is everything going to be okay? And the answer is not 100%. But if you're an older reader, if you're someone who loves fairy tales, that you could just jump in on this and be like, wow, there is some real stakes and some real risk in this story, and that hopefully it engage, you know, it's hopefully it's a true all ages book, and that it can engage you no matter, you know, what kind of reader you are.
Well, I mean, I think you kind of just answered this, but just to keep following this train of thought, this is not the Boom Studios imprint. This is the Boom Box imprint, which is their all ages line. So how far can you push it with something like that?
I know I've yet to get any notes. The first issue, a small spoiler alert, actually, sorry, the second issue, small spoiler alert, does involve a witch having prepared a child to eat, and the child has been roasted. It's a little bit in the background, but it's there. And this second book, it does get kind of dark. It gets dark because our hero starts doing things that are increasingly questionable, that are actually starting to frighten her brother and her grandmother. You know, they want to make sure Saoirse is strong. If she's not strong, we're all going to die. But what happens if she becomes, you know, what if happens if she actually becomes the last witch? What if she ends up fulfilling what this coven wants to do because of what the power turns her into? And it's also, I think, kind of intense because there are some really intense battles. The most intense battles in the book happen in this book too. And I think the first book had a couple of, as you're saying, you guys were talking about how, hey, there are some pretty big action set pieces, especially for an all ages book. And there's one twist that's in there that I think for some of the younger readers will probably be something that actually makes them go, whoa, hold on. Like, what just happened? Like, that's not supposed to happen in these kind of stories. And so I'm kind of excited about that. I have three kids of my own, and the older two have been telling me that they have not wanted me to tell them anything about this second book because they want to read it for themselves.
Just to check, they've been like, stop telling me stuff, Dad.
No spoilers, Dad.
God.
Look, you know, I don't like the elf on the shelf, and I certainly don't like the Alex in the bookshelf thing, right? Yeah. You should know these stories about me and my kids, all right?
Sorry.
Alex does watch over us all.
You're just staring down.
He watches like, over us.
Oh, yeah, hey, I got a whole wall of screens behind here. You can't see it, but it's fine.
You know, but I you know, it shows you care.
With something like this that is continuing the story, but I feel like it does such a good job of being measured and staying in the emotional range of the characters, like starting there before like blowing up the world in a way. Like, how do you modulate that when you're doing the next chapter in your story or a sequel to what has come before?
I mean, I think one of the things that maybe was kind of unconsciously working with me, because this was meant to be a book that was all ages, I didn't do it like intentionally, but I've noticed that there is almost a natural ebb and flow to the story. So when, you know, the first issue of the whole series and this issue, the first issue of book two, are actually really similar in that they start with a bit of a quieter moment. They start with a bit of joy. That joy kind of gets taken away as we set up the stakes of what is coming at us, but it gives us a chance to like get to know these characters, get to see the brother and the sister relationship, something that I think is really grounding, something that any reader can relate to, especially a younger reader. And I think that naturally, when the story gets intense, I think there was just a natural instinct to then say, okay, we've just had a really intense 20, 30 pages. Let's calm it down again. Let's give everybody a chance to like breathe. And maybe subconsciously, I was like, oh, for younger readers, maybe this is not a bad moment to give them a chance to laugh at something, to see themselves in the story, to have a moment to be like, whoa, we just went through a really scary moment. And now I can laugh a little and I can have some fun and I can, these characters are doing all the things that makes me, you know, that makes me love them because of the relationships they have and how they treat each other as a family. It wasn't a conscious decision, but rereading the book, I was like, oh yeah, that just is kind of how the structure worked. And I think, yeah, and, you know, starting book two, I mean, the weird thing is this was – The Last Witch was meant to originally be one big graphic novel. Mm-hmm. And then COVID came and blew up everybody's plans. And so there's actually was like a four-year gap between the end of book one and the beginning of book two being released. And so in a weird way, this was just – this was all written quite some time ago. So we made a few changes once we realized we were going to need to have a bit of a gap so that – you know, we tried to ease into that gap a little bit. You know, that first story with Hugh, who's one of the kind of trickster characters, he's talking with Saoirse's little brother, Braum, and he's talking about his adventuring. It's a way to almost kind of reintroduce him as a character because, it's been a while. But yeah, I don't know if I have a conscious plan for how to do this. It's just, I think it's the rhythm of any given story kind of tells you what the next issue needs to be.
It's cool. Interesting to hear. Oh, go ahead, Pete.
I just wanted to kind of touch it a little bit. I really love the artwork. You do such a great job kind of creating worlds and stuff to play in. What's it like to kind of have something live in your head and then kind of get to see it, you know, finally come to life? And what is your kind of like favorite process or what were some like wow moments with this?
I mean, I think like, you know, for any writer, for someone who's not a true cartoonist, it's always magical when you see somebody who's just this like brilliantly talented artist come in. Like, you know, I remember looking at Andy Belanger's first pages of Kill Shakespeare, like, you know, a million years ago and just being like, holy shit, like this is real now. Like before it was just like stupid thoughts in my head and Anthony Delcal's head. And now it's real. And with V it was a whole other level because their work is just like, it's spectacular. Like, I think I've written a really good story. Like, I'm really proud of this work, but V's artwork is unquestionably the star of this book, right? It is from the moment you open up the first page of book one, you are sucked into it. And somebody actually pointed something to me, which I hadn't thought of. They're like, V's character design is so simple and elegant. The facial expressions are very simple.
Yes.
They're very expressive, right? It's a very compact style of cartooning. And then you look at, like you were saying, Pete, you look at like the world that V then creates based on, you know, what I've given them. And like, you feel like you can step into every panel, right? When you're in a crumbling tower, you feel like you could just like walk off the side of the panel and there would be something there for you to explore. It's like the VR world of comics, right? Imagine if you could just be like, holy shit, like what if I just walked around this corner of the Fortress of Solitude and like, what would be there? And V has this, just this incredible gift of making such a simplistic style in one way and then having just so much incredible detail. And for me as a world builder, that's something that's so rewarding is when you feel like, holy, like this feels like a world I could explore and I want to explore. And, you know, also, of course, the colorist, Natalia Nestoranko, works originally V was going to color the book and then it became clear once we realized that we were going to expand it, it was going to be two volumes. It became clear that V was not going to have the time. And Natalia just jumped in and like, I think V and Natalia had like two short meetings and then it was just Natalia went off running with it. And every page, you know, and sometimes I've seen this where artists who are maybe going to color or have colored can get a little frustrated with the coloring they see. And there was none of that. V was just like this, you know, it was now it's her turn to be like, holy shit. Like, wow, this is, look at it. You've made it even more real now, Natalia. And so it was, you know, just kind of blessed with that team, honestly.
I did want to get back and ask you about you saying that the first one was planned as a graphic novel, because I'm not going to make a blanket statement here, but certainly reading habits of kids are obsessed with graphic novels. Like they are voracious for graphic novels. Monthly comics, maybe some of them. I mean, like my son is, but not quite as much. So I'm just curious from your perspective, because now you have released the first volume as monthly issues and as a full volume, and there's been enough time. What has the reaction been like from the younger audience to those two different releases, if any?
I mean, I think you're right, Alex, in that like, I don't think a ton of kids are, unless they've got parents who are big comics people, they're not really doing, you know, monthlies, right? They're not doing floppies, partially because probably their parents are not doing floppies, right? Like, unless you kind of already bring them into your home, you know, I don't know many parents who are like, oh wait, I don't go to comic shops, but I'm going to go to this comic shop now, you know, one Wednesday of the month for 7 months, and then realized that two times I came in, the book was delayed, and like, God damn it, you know, like to give you this kid this book, I'm just going to wait for the fucking book to come out when it's done. But I've been able to present this book to hundreds of kids at schools, you know, across Canada, the United States. I'm in France right now, so I've done a bunch of stuff in France, and kids, like, they really do respond to it. I you know, the patting myself on the back or something is, I think it has hit that sweet spot of there is this intensity. Like, for people who've read the book, in the early on, you meet one of the witches, Black Annis, and she is meant to be your classic, you know, Halloween style witch, but with just terrifying teeth, because, like I was saying, you know, she literally eats a child early in the story. And at one point, the only instructions I gave to V were those teeth, because it was a close up, and V drew the smile that there must be 100 needle
like teeth in this witch's mouth. Tiny teeth, and scarier.
Yeah, and they're creepy. And every time I show that to kids, or I show the fact that the witch has a snake's tongue, which is something that V just created in the story, the kids, like, they recoil. You get kids recoil, and then of course they lean in, because they've got to know, right? Like, they, you know, I think kids can handle as much as they can handle. If it's too much for them, they just turn away and they don't engage with it, and that's fine. But they want more. They want to be pushed a little bit. And so, the response from kids has really been, there's every once in a while you run into a kid who's like, I'm not into fantasy adventure, or, ooh, this seems a little scary for me. But everybody else I've run into is just like, they want the book immediately, right? Like, they're... get into our library, get into my hands. So it's been pretty cool. And here, I'm living in France right now. They don't do monthlies, right? That's not part of comics culture here at all. So that, like, I was trying to explain how the book came out to a bunch of kids in France who were, you know, payday readers, as they would call them here. And they were just sort of like, quoi?
Yeah. You know, like, why would you do it that way?
Yeah, right? Like, just give me the book, man. Like,
so, yeah, why are you being so sneaky about it?
Yeah, why are you being, just like, give me the book.
Well, speaking of which, you are going to have another full book that is going to come out as a graphic novel in October. Fella, Music is the Weapon. That's out October 7th, which is a very different thing than The Last Witch. Could you talk about that a little bit?
For sure, for sure. So Fella, Music is the Weapon is a book that I created with a friend of mine, a Nigerian-Canadian fine artist, Jabula Fugbamie. It's coming out on HarperCollins through their Amistad imprint. I think it's the second graphic novel they've ever done with that imprint. Mm. And for people who don't know who Fela Kuti is, he's a Nigerian musician, was huge in the 70s and 80s, was probably the second or third biggest musician in the world in his prime. But I like to say he is the Bob Marley of Africa. If Bob Marley had 55 plus albums, married 27 women at once, was arrested 200 times, and started his own country, right? That was Fela. All those things are actual things that happen in this guy's life. He is a sex, drugs, and rock and roll kind of dude. I've never written the word motherfucker so many times in my life as writing this book. He is he's a trickster. He is an asshole. He is brilliant and provocative. He is a guy who is challenging the Nigerian military government for basically what he thought was basically unchecked power, unchecked capitalism, right? You're running over the little people. Like, fuck you. No, not on my watch. We're going to talk about this. And what's kind of amazing is it's tied into the United States, because Fela was struggling a little bit early in his career. And he came up with this story that James Brown, who was hugely popular in Nigeria and who was an influence on his music, was listening, was actually playing his songs in America. And so he made up this whole story about how James Brown and all these classic American soul artists were playing his music in America. And if only somebody would send him on a tour to America, he could cash in and they would all get rich. And somebody read the paper, was like, yeah, we'll do it. And so they brought him to America completely on this made up story that Fela put out there. And then they didn't show up at the airport. And in fact, they didn't actually book any dates on his tour. So Fela ended up being like, you know, these assholes who I tricked, they fucked me. And so he's stuck in the States. And he ends up in California playing at a club owned by the actor who, Bernie Hamilton, who played the commander in Starsky and Hutch, their boss, which is just a weird little connection. Yeah. And he ran into this woman who was a member of the Black Panthers. And Fela, when he was in the beginning of his life, he was like, the problem with Africa is Africans, right? Like, you look at Europe, You look at America, it works, right? Africa, it doesn't work. We have all this black power, and all we have are blackouts. And this woman, Sandra, was like, you need to shut your fucking mouth. And so she gave him Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and Marcus Garvey, all these great books. And Fella realized that he had been so kind of brainwashed by British colonial thinking that he had been like, oh, yeah, there's something wrong with us. And then he comes back and he's like, oh, no, no, this is because we've been subjugated. Because people have told us that the way we did things for thousands of years, it worked perfectly well for us until we got encountered by, you know, a more warlike culture, that this was all a fault of our own. And that changes his life entirely. He goes from a guy who's singing about, literally singing about soup, to a guy who starts naming names, and it culminates in the fact that he pisses off the Nigerian government and military so much that they send 1,000 soldiers, they burn down his compound, they beat the shit out of everybody there, they do like the worst things imaginable to the women in the compound, everything you can imagine, and worse. And they take his mother, who was actually key in getting Nigeria their independence, and they throw her, 70-something years old, they throw her out of a second-floor window, which eventually leads to her death. And
oh my God.
The first thing he does, they beat him so badly, Fella's like, I see I saw my spirit leave my body. And they beat him so badly, and he barely survives. And the first thing he does when he's able to get out of hospital, still all bandaged up, is he goes on stage and he sings the exact song called Zombie, which is a great song if anybody wants to listen to it. He sings that song again, basically saying, fuck you, you're not going to beat me. but yeah, he's a wild character. It is your classic, you know, like the Dewey Cox story, the Walk Hard, like, it, you know, yeah. You know, that all those beats, like it really does. His life does follow those beats. It's not a story. You don't need to know anything about Nigeria or Afrobeat or any of that. If you're just somebody who's like interested in interesting people and is willing to dive into a book that's going to say, hey, we're going to, through what Fela said, we're going to explore some of what our world is about. And you can agree with what Fela said. You can disagree. I don't agree with everything Fela says, right? He's a complex character. He said some stuff that I think is kind of stupid, but he also said a lot of stuff that's incredibly brilliant. And so it's really just an interesting book. If you have any love for music, anything like that, I think, you know, it's a book that you not going to read it to your kids, but
yeah,
it might be a book
sort
that
of a gear change from Worst Witch.
Witch. But it might be a book that when they get a little older that you want to hand them and say, you know what, like, This might give you a different perspective on how the world works. And for Jebola, who is a Nigerian Canadian, for him, the big thing was he was like, you know, so much of how we reflect Africa is through the lens of slavery stories, right? It's the suffering and this overcoming and this ability for the people from Africa to and their descendants to just like endure. And he's like, that's great. Like, it's true. Like, you know, the African people are incredible at enduring. But he's like, it's so limiting in terms of the experience of what Africa and Africans are. And it just was important for him to show that, you know, here's a guy, and he is complex, and he is flawed, and he's filled with joy, and the book is filled with joy and misery and everything that everybody else explores. But it's not just the, you know, it's not reducing anybody's experience to this one horrific. And then, you know, again, you get why people do, you get why we are fascinated with that story because of how huge that story is. But it was something that was really important to us to just, you know, to just show a different perspective. So that's very different thing. We worked on it for about 10 years, and it's I'm excited it's out because I'm not working on it anymore. Yeah, we worked on it for about 10 years off and on from kind of the beginning when he first came up to me at a house party I used to throw. That was like, hey, I got an idea. Do you know, what do you think? So that's where it all started.
And sorry, just to dive in on that, like what were those 10 years parceled out with, like changing the story, research, jumping back and forth with sort of how you want to tell the story?
Or do you just type very slowly?
I want to hear more about the house party. I was like, what kind of house party was it? You know what I mean?
It was called Bring a Stranger. It was a great start. You guys can steal it. So Bring a Stranger, the idea was I had a buddy of mine who was an accountant, and one day he was talking about his friend who was a ballerina. And I was like, how the fuck do you know a ballerina? Like, how do I not know you know a ballerina? I'm the arty guy. You're not allowed to have arty friends.
Yeah. I bring fun people to you.
Yeah. And so that kind of birthed the idea of like, so I invited a bunch of my friends. I was like, you have to bring somebody I don't know. You have to bring a stranger. Yeah,
that's awesome.
And so that's how it started. And then eventually the strangers all got on the list. And so by the time, you know, we probably threw 8 or 10 of these parties over a few years. And by the end, it was just like third, fourth generation strangers, people I would only have met. I held them at my house. People would just invade. We'd have like 140 people in my house, and at sometimes I might have known like 15 of them, and we'd have these waves of people, like, you know, it gets to 3 o'clock and, you know, about 2:30 in the morning the bars close in Toronto, And so you get around 3:15, you'd be like, all right, we're going to get about 50 people are going to show up.
Time for the strangest strangers to get here. Yeah.
And at a certain point, and we used to be able to set our watch at around 2:15, my neighbor would have had a few beers on his, and we'd always be like, come on over. He'd be like, no, I'm not coming, man. And then around 2:15 in the morning, you'd hear this thump because he'd like scaled the fence between our two decks and our little apartment building and fallen. And people be like, some dude's fallen. And people be like, no, that's okay. It's just Rick. Don't worry. Like, you know, people who never met this guy, but had come to this party five times. Like, oh, yeah, it's like 2:15. Yeah, the neighbor's going to fall over and like just pop up and just grab a beer. Like, it was a thing. But to answer your question, I mean, the first part was we spent a lot of time trying to really figure it out, because obviously Fela's not a household name in North America unless you're, you know, a certain type of music head. And so we tried to figure out, like, what would make this story? Like, how do we make this accessible? How do we make this about something universal? Because what Fela was talking about was universal. And so we did a ton of work on the book. Originally, Jabola wanted to just do that raid I told you about. He wanted to just do a short comic about the raid.
Oh, yeah.
And he had some really cool visual metaphor ideas for that. And when he gave it to me, he first just came to me to be like, hey, what do you think? Can you give me some advice? And I came back and I was like, look, the Fela's story is so amazing. I knew a teeny bit about him before Jabola started talking to me. And then I started to do my research. And there's so many crazy stories about this guy. And I was like, I think you should do like a complete book on him, because there's just so much. I honestly think a lot of you'll really kill your audience, because you're going to do this niche moment in this guy's, in a niche artist's like life. People won't understand it unless they already know him. And that would be a shame. And that's when he came back to me and was like, I don't want to write that. Would you write it? And so I spent a little bit of time being like, should I write it? Like, you know, I am not Nigerian. That may be a shock to some people in the audience. And so like, I took a little time thinking like, is this really a story for me to be able to tell? And, you know, and then, you know, basically where Jabola and I ended up is like, look, like Jabola's Nigerian. We're not going to fuck up the Nigerian part of things because he knows it. And the rest is research, because Fela's a public figure. And so it's like, yeah, we can do this together. We're fine. We're good. And in fact, maybe there's something about a multiracial team doing this kind of book that actually says something. But, you know, we took it slow. It took us a while to figure out what we wanted to pitch. And then it was just, I mean, Jabola works full time. He's a UX designer. So, you know, it was for him, he was a fine artist. So it took him a while to figure out his own rhythm for comics. He'd done a little bit of comics before, like a couple of private projects. And so it took a little while to find the rhythm for us to get to where we needed to get so that he could produce the pages that he wanted to produce. And he's a perfectionist. So a lot of times he'd be like, yeah, I don't like this page. Like, I'm going to have to go back and change it. And I'd be like, dude, it's fine. Like, honestly, it's not worth it. It's this one little panel. Like, it's good. Like, you know, perfect being the enemy of good. And he won't mind if I tell this. But like, of course, then whenever I was like, hey, Jabola, I think you need to change this because I think this is a problem. He'd be like, no way, man. Like, fuck you. And then like, you know, 2 days later, he'd come back and be like, yo, bro, so I was thinking what you said. And like, yeah, you're right. I changed it. In fact, I actually redid the last three pages. And I'm like, no, Jabola, no, you misunderstood the assignment. Like, just that one panel. Just because the acting was wrong. That's like, come on, man. He's like, no, but it's so much better. And it always would be better. And HarperCollins was patient, so it worked out well. I think they saw the pages and were like, oh, wow, this is, you know, I'm not going to say it's a unique book because I think there's a few things in comics that do this, but it's part of a small school of books that is it's really incredible. I can't wait to be able to share it with you guys. We don't have that PDF yet, but I can't wait to share it with you guys.
Sounds awesome.
It's a pretty crazy book.
Congratulations. That's awesome. Both of these things sound awesome, Connor. Before we let you go, obviously those are two very big projects. Is there anything else you would like to plug?
I mean, yes. So early next year in 2026, my horror comedy series Trickster is going to start coming out with Twisted Publications, which is a little boutique publication out of the UK. It is the story of a master illusionist who has to, it's kind of a monster of the week thing, a master illusionist who's got to keep these monsters from Irish mythology. Again, Irish mythology, these were not supposed to be released this close together. who's trying to keep all these monsters from Irish mythology from preying on human beings while also hiding the fact that he is one of these monsters himself. And it is done with Neil Gibson, who does the Twisted Dark series. And it is very funny at times, but it is also, if anybody knows Neil's work, it's going to be quite dark at times. We're really hoping to add the phrase ironing the baby to the lexicon.
Yes. I hear that a lot in Brooklyn
baby.
Here.
Yeah. The old iron the baby. Hey, yeah. Hey, Jim. Hey, Clem, what time is it? Is it time to iron the baby?
You betcha. That's how I heard it.
You betcha.
Well, Connor, this all sounds great as well. Looking forward to that. And, of course, I will be watching you and your kids. So thanks for coming on.
Really nice. I appreciate it, Alex. You know what? My wife and I are actually going to maybe try to sneak away for a meal like tomorrow night. So if you could just be on
there. I'll put the audio on.
Babysitter on the shelf over here.
Exactly.
Thanks, Connor. Good seeing you.
Thanks, Connor. Great stuff. Guys.
All right, there we go. Once again, to plug that stuff, you could check out The Last Witch, Blood and Betrayal, number one, out June 18th from Boombox. And Fella, Music is the Weapon is out October 7th from HarperCollins Amistad imprint. So check both of those things out.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
And next up, we're going to talk to our next guest, who Woo-hoo! Is another returning guest here. He has an amazing comic called The Left Hand Path, which is getting a second printing or just got a second printing. But very excited to talk about this. Ladies and gentlemen, Scott Brian Wilson.
Hey,
hello. Oh,
cheers,
yes.
Thanks for having me.
There it is.
Blow.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah.
Awesome. Excited to have you back. Excited to talk about this book. So let me sort of lay this out here as best I can, but it starts with a bunch of folks that are exploring a spaceship, and over the course of the book, it jumps forward almost every page or two, sometimes more often, sometimes a little less often, but thousands of years. It goes through multiple generations as they're exploring their ship. This is one of the wildest books I've ever read. I was super impressed, but my main question immediately afterwards, given that multiple of the pages, you're cutting in on characters who already have relationships, already have backstories, they're in the midst of their stories, and then cutting away from them to something else. How do you plan something like that? How do you actually lay it out? I mean, I know straight. That's sort of like the first question you got all the time, but I was like, do you have a 25,000-page version of this somewhere that you just cut down, or how did it work?
Well, actually, the first version we did, I think, was 20 pages. And I had the idea of jumping forward in time as they explore the ship that's so enormous that, you know, they can't find the center of it. And these, you know, they split off into different civilizations and their languages change and, you know, all these things. But yeah, the original version was about 20 pages and we finished it. And then I read it through and I was like, I called Ken Knudsen, who's the artist. And I was like, hey, man. We got some pages. There's some stuff I forgot, right? Like I realized there were better, there were things so I could go. And then I realized after we added another 8 pages or so, I was like, we could keep doing this forever. I could just keep adding 2-page stories in the timeline and it could be 1,000 pages long, right? So it was really about like, what are the strongest ones we tell that tell the story, you know, and where do we sort of end it? So, it wasn't mapped out as meticulously as I normally map out everything I write. It was definitely like, it was a lot of fun to keep sort of thinking about what's missing, like maybe emotionally what's missing or creep wise what's missing, right? Like what's something creepy that we haven't, you know, so sort of filling in some of those gaps was a lot of fun.
And on the, while we're talking sort of format and time, like why a one shot? I feel like there's such a, everyone's like, here's my series or here's my limited series. It's 5 issues. And this is just like so so composed and contained?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of reasons. I mean, one is Ken is not a fast artist. As you can see, his work is really detailed.
It's unbelievable.
I love it.
Really beautiful art. And in a sense of like, I want to work with him and I want it to come out. Right. So like, let's just right, do something sure. self-contained. But I think the other thing too, is like, I sort of realized, I mean, we've been working on this book for a long time, you know, we've been chipping away at it a long time. But I think I realized somewhere in there too, like having other things come out during that time, you know, and, you know, miniseries and things like that. And, you know, tabling at comic conventions, it's like, it's so much easier to sell something that's the whole story in one go, right? Versus like number one of a series, right? So to me, this felt like it's kind of a self-contained story. It didn't need to be 98 pages. I thought we could really pack in. It was almost like, how much story can we pack into 28 pages, right? And I think we ended up, you know, I think we did all right. I think it's a pretty good book.
Yeah.
It's definitely packed. Well, talking even more, not to push you too much on this, because it sounds like it was maybe more improvisational than I would expect, but let's say you're going in and you're breaking down a two-page thing where you are cutting in on these sub-characters mm-hmm. 200 years ahead. Mm-hmm. What is your thought process that goes into something like that? How do you determine, okay, here's who's going to show up on this page, this is what the relationship is to the previous page that took place right. 200 years earlier, and to the next page that's going to be 200 years beyond that?
Yeah, I think I just thought about, like, you know, what has happened in the world, right? The world of the book since then, right? Like, I wanted to show the sort of civilizations changing and people sort of branching off and language changing and the way that they sort of now talk about things that we've already seen, but it's different than what we saw, you know? So now you've got history, right? Like how does sort of history happen, quote unquote, right? And so for me, it was about what can I add to the world that we haven't seen yet, but also be like a sort of emotional investment, right? So, but yes, I tried to make them all these pretty significant jumps into the middle of things without any introduction, because I didn't want it to feel like we're just holding the reader's hand, right? Like I really wanted it to feel very kind of disjointed in a fun way, right? Like once you realize, oh, I'm not actually going to get the full story of any of these people, right? Then, you know, I think you can kind of just settle in and enjoy the book for what it is and embrace the sort of weirdness and horror of it.
First, I want to say, sick library you got behind you there.
Thanks, dude. I just moved into a new headquarters, so I just got wow. my bookcases set up in my room, so in my office. So yeah.
Well, awesome. It seems like you're surrounding yourself with good stuff. Secondly, we saw, I want to circle back to the art a little bit. When it comes to something that is so kind of like art forward, like this mm-hmm. is, mm-hmm. it seems like less is more. We saw that giant splash page that looked part watercolor, part like mm-hmm. unbelievable shading and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. What is the back and forth with the artist where like you might have plans for this whole page where it almost seems like, you know what, screw everything that I had kind of laid out. Yeah. It's just more powerful to kind of showcase the art. Like,
yeah. Well, I had worked with Ken. We'd done a few stories together before this. So I knew I wrote it specifically for him. And as I recall, you know, I just wrote the script without telling him and sent it to him. And I was like, this is our next thing. We're going to do it. You have to draw this because I wrote it for you. Right. Like, and I, you know, I felt as I wrote it for him, as I was writing it, I could only see it drawn by him. And so, you know, it's depending on which artist I work with, I always write as best I can specifically for them and to their strengths. So I knew kind of what Ken does really well and what he can really sort of bring to life. I didn't really have any comments much on the art or the world building at all. I left pretty much all of that to him. I think the only thing I asked was, because he colored it himself with oil bars. I think the only thing I asked was that he make the gutters up between the panels all just pure white, like go on Photoshop and clean them up and make them all white. That was the only thing I said, because he had them spilling over. And I just thought that would kind of like tighten them up and really sort of frame every panel even, you know, more strongly, you know.
Yeah.
That was really the only art note. And again, it was like, you know, as as Connor was saying and your previous guest was saying, you know, it's, you know, seeing the pages as they come in, it's just like, yeah, this is so much better than I had hoped for. You know, this is so much better than, you know, I mean, I've been really really lucky to work with a lot of incredible artists. And Ken is one of my favorites. Is just seeing his pages come in, it's like magical, really.
Yeah, it's moving.
Hearing you say that about sort of cleaning up the gutters as your note back, it had me thinking about your afterword. You write, "All I think about is terror." Well, terror and comics, mm-hmm. And it feels like keeping those gutters clean is sort of being like, get in the comic, terror. Stay in there. So how does that work when you are you struck by some terror and you're like, how can I turn this into a comic? Is it the other way around? Like, how are you doing what you're saying?
Experimenting with terror and then putting it in comics?
Yeah, I mean, I said all I think about is terror, but I also think about serial killers a lot too. So there's like,
That's a good balance.
That falls under terror.
Yeah, so, you know, I there's a few things, but I think, you know, I always think about things that make me uncomfortable, you know, and Ken and I had done a couple of other stories that were basically about being just totally uncomfortable and super creepy and very sort of moody, you know, shorts. I like horror a lot, but I don't particularly find most horror very scary, right? Like, there's very little I find that's actually like scary to me. So I think when I write horror, I try to think like, I just want to be really uncomfortable and dark and scary. And I want people to keep thinking about it right after, you know, it's not about it's not about like the jump scares. It's more about the kind of, this is kind of gross feeling, and now I keep thinking about it, you know. So
is there something on your mind from that terror point of view or uncomfortability that you're working out now? And I'll give you a second to think by talking about your other work. I feel like True Cult really did that for me. I feel like that you found the terror in a lot of everyday, like you went sort of dipped into everyday and then dipped out into some bigger ideas and then sewed us back into everyday. And that extra loop back is what made, I was like, oh no, I am uncomfortable now. So like, is there something you're kicking around now that sort of finds that same loop to loop?
I have we just finished the first issue of another book I'm doing with Marcos Mars, and I guess maybe remember him. He drew Detective Comics in the 15 years ago or something. Great artist, left comics for a long time, but he's coming back. We're doing a book together. It's super fucking dark and bleak, but like I think like Kilmore, which I came on and talked to you guys about before.
Yeah.
Kilmore, it's fucking dark, but like not so dark that like you can't read it, right? Like I think like with Kilmore, right, like writing about serial killers, you know, it's like if you were really gonna like write about like actual serial killers, it would be so fucking bleak and hopeless and terrifying that it wouldn't be enjoyable for anybody to read. Like it takes a really sort of specific mind frame to sort of ingest that kind of stuff, and while I am the type of mind who enjoys that, right, like I get like it's not an entertaining comic for 99% of comics readers, right? So we have a new thing that's very dark and bleak but is approached in the same way that like Kilmore and True Cult are, which is with a heavy sort of dose of comedy to sort of try to try to balance it out, where you're like, oh my god, that was super disturbing, but there was also some funny things that happened in it, so I'm gonna keep reading, you know. So you know, it's sort of, for me, it's always playing that sort of balancing act. And sort of I think with, like you mentioned with True Cult, it's like you go into these tiny moments. For me, it's always thinking about like these things that just seem super inconsequential and making them a big part of the book, right? And the reader's like, why the fuck is he talking about this, right? Like, but when you step back, it all kind of sort of makes this big, you know, quilt, right, that tells a story or something. So
I mean, just to ask you about it, and I hope this isn't too touchy of a subject, but is there any chance for more Kilmore, or is
yes,
that
yes, there is? Yes, 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 okay. Yeah, yeah. It's gonna be finished. Yeah, we had a creative impasse with the publisher. And by which I mean I refuse to make my comic shitty.
good for you.
Good.
And, I said, look, man, like if we make these changes, the book's gonna suck. I'm gonna hate it. You're gonna hate it. Readers are gonna hate it. So what the fuck is the point? Why would we do this, right? And so, you know, I just said, hey, look, just give me no hard feelings. Like, I get it. Like, give me the rights back. So I got the rights back. We have another publisher for it. We have 6 issues done. But it, you know, Max, who's drawing it, got a day job, so it's kind of slowed. The progress has slowed down a bit. But yeah, that's going to be coming out, you know, I don't know, hopefully next year sometime. But I think we're going to do it just as a graphic novel rather than fucking around with single issues, right, at this point. Smart. Like, what's the point, right? Like, just do it. Because then I'm at a show, I don't have to sell the number one that nobody wants, because then they got to find 2 through 10. They just buy the whole fucking thing, right? So, and it's going to be a real satisfying, really thick book. It's completely written. We got 6 issues and some done. So,
awesome.
It's probably the best thing I've written when you read it all together. I'm still super excited about it. It's still my baby. And I think by the time it actually comes out, we'll have beat Connor's record for the 10 years on the Phalanx.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Because I think this was 8 years when the first issue came out, which was what, 2 years ago. So, you know, we're at 10 years. So at another one or two, it's going to be another 12 years or something.
Oh, man.
But yeah, I mean, that's comics, right? Like, a lot of this shit is like, that's creator owned comics, at least, right? For the most part, other than like the occasional, like, you know, superstar who has the Batman project or something they're chipping away at for 20 years or whatever. But, yeah, that's creator on comics, man. It's like you do them as you can, and you know, you hope that you know, it will be responded to with something other than deafening indifference when it comes out. So,
Well, I mean, to that point, and to loop it back to the Left-Hand Path, like we said, the book came out in 2023. It's getting a second printing now, 2 years later.
Yeah.
So that's pretty crazy. Like, I mean, I assume the basic thing that led to that was it sold out, but why the second printing now? Why the second printing after all this time?
So it sold out almost immediately, right? Obviously wasn't like a gigantic print run or anything, but like still like, oh, sold out, which is great. But it was either the first or the second comic that Dead Sky Publishing was the publisher. And it was the first or the second comic that they published. And when it sold out, there wasn't really any mechanism in place, infrastructure, money to like, oh, let's put another second printing on the schedule right now. Right. So it was like, well, we got to figure it out. And I think they had a bunch of other stuff coming out. And then, you know, finally the timing lined up and they were like, we're going to do it. So, you know, like, I think they see it the way we see it, which is like, this is an evergreen book, right? Like, you just sell it forever. Just sell it forever, right? There are always going to be more people who like horror and sci-fi who are going to dig it. So, yeah, really excited about the second printing. Really glad that it's back in print. It's available. You know, you can get your... I mean, theoretically, you can get your comic store to order it. I don't fucking know with all this diamond shit. I don't know, but... Theoretically, you can get an order. If not, you can go to Dead Sky Publishing website. You can order from there. They got a bunch of cool stuff. I also wrote a horror western for them called 3 Days to Death Is Here, and you can also get that at the same time if you want. It's super violent, has a lot of swearing in it, which, if you've read any of my work, is probably not a really surprise.
You can see that. I can see that happening.
Yeah, I mean, it's something in that realm. Yeah. Scott, this book is so good. I'm so excited that Kilmore is coming back as well. Excited to see that finish.
Very cool.
Congrats.
Before we let you go, what's in your glass, Scott? What are you sipping?
What are you drinking?
Old Crow.
Yes.
You know this bullshit?
I do,
it's garbage.
I'm there for you. I hear you.
It's terrible. But I tell you, like, we just bought this new house, and the expenses have been quite high. So I was like, maybe I'll see.
Let me just downgrade it. It's a downgrading time. It's a downgrading time.
Look at this fucking Old Crow, and I'm like, man, this is fucking true alcoholic shit.
That's amazing, Scott. So good seeing you again. Congrats on all the success.
Take care of yourself.
Looking forward to the next one.
Thank you. Really good to see you guys again. Thanks for having me back on.
Yeah. Come back anytime. Next book. Absolutely. Love to see you.
Thanks.
All right, there we go. Again, oh, that man. Was Scott Bride Wilson. The book is called The Left-Hand Path. It's from Dead Sky Publishing. It's
worth it for the art alone.
It yeah. is. Also
the and writing. The writing. And the
writing. Writing, Pete.
Okay. Jesus. I'm just saying, it's so good. There's a lot of levels to it. It's my point.
Really?
You only called out one level. That's all I'm saying.
All right, well, I tried.
That's his sort of, he's really trying to own that level.
Mm-hmm. Own the artistic level. He's our artistic yeah. investigator, is basically what he is.
A opinion. Lot of people say that. People quoting, I heard someone typing nanners into the chat here.
Yeah. And we're going to have more stuff typed into the chat because it's time for my favorite section, because you all make it up. It is your audience questions.
Yeah.
And for audience questions, all you got to do is drop a question in the comments and we will get to it here on the show. In the meantime, I will give a shout out to Brett Macris, Stray Bullies,
Stray Bullies
of Shift down in New Orleans, who picked yeah. the refreshing Petey Palmer for this week, which is a delicious drink. You can check it out if you're a member of our Comic Book Club Discord. Drop the question, not drop the question, drop the recipe in there, and it is delightful. What are you guys drinking, though? Pete?
I have a question. I just want to remind you not to forget the write-in question.
Oh, thank you for your question about that. I'll open that up right now. But, Pete, what are you drinking?
I'm drinking, still going through this Fatheads Brewery Variety Pack, and this one's Wicked Willie's. Fucking Wicked Willies guy.
Wicked Willies. I'm getting my body ready for the summer with a little upstate. All the way upstate to Canada with a little. Oh, yeah. You got that. I mailed that. I dropped it off on your porch like a psychopath.
Yeah. You mail him all your bottle caps, right?
Yeah. It's a little thing we do. It's a serial killer thing that I'm working with Scott on, being a serial killer that he can write about.
So as Pete helpfully reminded me, we got an email a couple of weeks back and I kept forgetting to read it, but this is from Luke Asink, sent it through and I thought it was
hey, Luke Asink!
Luke Asink. That's how we say it when we say his name once a month. I was talking about Spider-Man with my 5-year-old and he had the idea that if he just found 2 giant spiders he could hold in his hands and make them shoot webs, he would have the same powers without getting bitten by a radioactive spider. Have any comics been written about this or something similar? There's been some weird storylines and villains over the years, and if anyone knows, it would be you guys. Thanks for the show. I've been a fan for years.
Oh, Lucas Sink.
Shout out to Lucas Sink. But yeah. to clarify the question, Luke is saying a situation where someone, rather than having spider powers, holds spiders yeah. and shoots webs, like squeezes yeah. them.
You use the old squeeze and shoot with the old spider webs. First yeah, off, yeah, Lucas, think you have a very creative child, and I hope that his creativity stays with him because that's a fantastic imagination. And what a fun way to think about it, you know what I mean? Where you don't need, if you just had the spiders in your hands. The problem is I feel like squeezing the spider, you get upset and probably bite you, and you're going to get bit anyway, you know what I mean? So,
well, unless the spiders understand the great power and responsibility they have to do the right thing and
You have to establish first, does the spider have an Uncle Ben? If the spider has an Uncle Ben, it's going to know about what Justin's talking about. And
yeah.
Here's what I'm saying. Get a young spider, and then it's that spider's Uncle Ben in the other hand. Oh. And you can squeeze them alternatively and really...
Oh, so you're the robber in this case and you're squeezing...
Yes, even yes. The hero is the villain. The hero is the villain.
Don't squeeze my Uncle Ben.
To answer the question, though, I haven't heard that. And that's a great... In a Marvel universe...
It's pronounced in a world.
Really yes. good.
Here's what I would say. Oh, go ahead. Finish.
I would say in a universe where there is a Spider-Verse, I think this is a huge potentiality.
Yes.
Yeah, Spider
the one that I would say is closest is probably Spider's Man, who is the Peter Parker who is made out of spiders, but not the same thing.
No.
So there you go. So good on Luke's son. Great question. Let's get to one from here online. Schreckler says, following up from the talk Alex didn't give today, what are some intercompany...
Didn't give today?
So we were rained out. I was supposed to give a talk
Brian
on
Park
Archie
speech.
Meets...
Yeah, I wanted to hear how that went.
Yeah, Archie meets Batman 66. That's what we were supposed to do. And I will tell you, I was pretty excited. I chatted with Jeff Parker, who lives on the other coast, but I got some like inside info that I was going to share with the crowd on it and everything. But
really cool. Let me ask you, Alex, why are you so scared of the rain? Why are you terrified?
I was already at West 4th Street on the subway when they called me. It was the sound guy who was scared of the rain. He was like, didn't want to be electrocuted or something. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Classic sound guy move. Yes.
Anyway, I was going to be doing one on June 20th. Now we're going to do about two Archie comics books. It's going to be about Archie Meets Batman 66. And also, I'm forgetting the exact name, but it's the collection of the Archie comics by Mark Waid and Fiona Staples.
So now you got to double up. You got to condense two. Wow. No,
that's fine. I feel like I could do that. I'm not too worried. But per what Strickler is saying, what are some intercompany crossovers that have worked for you? And what are some that didn't?
I thought the question is, what do you do when things are rained out? I thought that's what Schuykler was asking, but I guess I read into it.
If you just read the words, Pete, you can see that's not what he was asking.
Rain is kind of like a crossover between the sky and the ground, though.
Yeah, oh, sure. Man, that's really good. That's really smart.
That's what I was talking about.
Actually, just because I did prep for this talk today, I could throw out there some stuff that you guys probably know, but maybe some of our listeners don't. I didn't realize that crossovers actually went all the way back to 1940. The first recorded crossover in comics, I think, was between, I'm forgetting what it was called. It was like National Comics and DC Comics, but it was all characters that eventually ended up in DC Comics. So it's kind of the same thing anyway. But it wasn't really until like the 1980s with Superman versus Spider-Man or anything like that, that crossovers really became a bigger thing. So
I remember when Richie Rich crossed over with Hot Stuff. My mind was blown when I was a kid when that happened.
I feel like you're not taking this question seriously.
They're part of the same universe. What part of the Hot Stuff universe
when
blew your mind?
Superman and Batman crossed over.
Oh, I couldn't believe it.
I lost my mind. I mean, I think, I feel like we were talking about this a couple of weeks ago, but the Superman Aliens and Batman Predator stuff actually worked shockingly well. Like
Batman and a lot of things work well. Batman, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Great take.
You know what I mean? He's a versatile guy.
let me throw out one I liked: Batman, Hellboy, Starman.
Ooh, of course,
which was
of course,
sort Starman, of surprising two on one crossover.
There should be a drinking game where it's like anytime Justin sneaks in Starman, you got
to
drink.
You should have heard how hard I was thinking in my brain to mention Jeff Smith's bone during our interview with Connor,
Thing, I actually don't know the answer to this, and I've been curious to check it out given the crossovers that are happening later this year. I don't think I ever actually read any of the Amalgam stuff. Like, I saw it in stores.
You
and I was
never
like,
read it?
Never read it. I was like, this really? Looks weird. And that's kind of where the thought process stopped. Was it any good? Because it seemed like it was not good from the outside.
I mean, it was inherently gimmicky and forced a bit, but like that was baked into the premise. So like there was some interesting stuff that happened, but truly, it was like jamming a series of square pegs into a series of round holes.
When you say the Amalgam, what the fuck are you talking about?
Great question. Great question, Pete.
What are you saying?
The Amalgam universe was a DC Marvel crossover where they were like, it was like Batman Wolverine. It was like Bat-Vereen.
Darkclaw. Darkclaw. Soldier. Was it like Soldier Supreme or something like that?
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. Yes, they crossed it all over. It was a character called Access who forced the event to happen. And my pet theory is they're going to do Amalgam 2 next year because it's the 30th anniversary of the Amalgam event. And they've kind of teased that they're like, yeah, we're doing this Deadpool Batman 2-part crossover at the end of the year. We're going to do another one next year. Maybe there'll be more. And I think the more like is I think they're slowly leading up to that.
Yeah, another one that crossed my mind where I was like, why would they do this, was the issue of Spawn that Cerebus appeared in.
Oh, yeah.
You know what that reminds me? I think that's
Cerebus
the first crossover.
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles was
that was the first crossover I ever read, was Cerebus Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Yeah. And it worked exactly as planned because I was like, who's this guy? I want to know more about this guy. I'm
that did
the Turtles
work really
this
well.
This guy's weird.
Yeah.
The other one, and this is top of mind because of the Archie thing, and then we can move on to the next question, but I would say Archie versus the Predator was one that absolutely should not have worked and was great.
Archie Punisher was also really. I mean, but that was great. That you got that kind of like skull and spine in the vending machine. Yeah, I remember that.
That was good. I liked it. Yeah,
that was good.
Yes, you guys looked at me like I was crazy for a second. I was worried. So.
No, we were thinking. Yeah. We're processing what you said.
No. Podcast, no thanky, all talky.
No, that's true. That's the back of our t-shirts.
Grandpa Zalvin.
No thanky.
This segues nicely into Michael Tilbin's question. Why is Predator Killers the best Predator movie after Prey? First of all, Michael, that is a correct take. Prey is the best one. Predator Killer of Killers absolutely rules.
No, I feel like
Michael
has
the
original. You can't.
No, you don't.
This drives me nuts.
No, you don't.
You can't talk about something's. The thing that started it, you got to give it its due. Okay, the first Predator movie.
What was the best year of your life? Was it the first year?
One. Yes, it was. Everything was all new and exciting.
Pete loves milk.
What is this? What? Yeah, come on.
Pete loves.
And let me be honest. Pete loves laying down, so I'm sure he was much happier then. Goo goo gaga, tickle tickle. Let me also say, Pete, you sit down. You have a choice between watching Alien or Aliens. What do you press and play on?
Okay, well, I mean, Aliens is a better movie than Aliens.
Oh, wow, look who just threw away all their morals.
Credibility gone. The page out.
Damn it, you got me on that one.
Predator Killer of Killers, if anybody hasn't checked it out, is on Hulu now. It's an animated anthology, I'm putting it in quotes, because there's some fun surprises there. It is awesome. The animation is fantastic. The story is fantastic. It is great. So good. Christopher Parker says, do you guys actively collect old comics? If so, what titles?
Great call. Great question. I am not actively seeking. I feel like there's a lot of people who are like, oh, I'm trying to fill out my Silver Age Superman collection. I'm not doing that actively right now, but I am a sucker for anytime I go into a comic book store to go through and be like, oh, looky here. I just bought a bunch of random Impact titles, a couple issues of Concrete that I haven't had, I don't have in the floppy.
Whatever.
If I encounter something, I'm like, oh man, gotta have it. Just gotta have it.
Yeah, I agree with the JT says on that. Where I feel like there isn't something that I'm actively collecting, but if I find myself in a comic book shop, I'm gonna see what oldies they got.
Find
and
yourself.
Also, you know, kind of. Well, yeah, I want to seek out. I like to show up to different comic book shops, check them out. But I think that, like, I'd like to see what every shop has when I say, like, you got an Eastman and Laird Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Just because.
Just to check.
Just to see.
You don't even buy it.
If I have, like, only one copy of that issue and maybe it's a beat up copy and they got a better one, maybe I'll buy it. You know what I mean?
Oh, there you go. Trade up. So you're saying, sorry, just to check, like if you have a copy of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, you're going to get the newer one that you found replacing the original. So you would say one is better than the original.
No, that way I can have one that I can keep like reading and then one that I don't touch that is.
And then one you can throw away.
Right.
No, throw away.
You
what
can
the hell,
bundle kind of... up into a ball and tell
a lot of that? Times I'll be like, I'll see a bunch of old Eastman and Laird comics just in the trash. You should check the trash, people.
How dare you?
Look in the dumpsters.
You know, this is, I was reading this the other day. Eastman and Laird said that they originally started doing Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles to make a nest for raccoons.
Yeah. A lot of the best raccoons.
Interesting. Prime Music says, question for you all. You check out the new announced Marvel and the new Invincible fighting game trailers released in the last week. Are you guys familiar with these?
I'm familiar with Prime Music. You know what I mean?
So the first one, to take the backwards because I am a little more familiar with the Invincible game, that's called Invincible Versus. It's the very early stages. Skybound raised a ton of money. Not through a crowdfunder. It was like, I honestly don't know what the financial term is, but like basically they raised money to create what they call a AAA game studio. And their first out of the gate is basically like a Mortal Kombat style game, but for the Invincible universe.
Oh,
so
man.
They
Fair.
Promised
That's awesome.
It's going to be bloody and gory. And
oh,
all
of course
the
it is.
Guts you want to see out of Invincible
You're
game.
You're going to punch through people. So, it's going to be crazy.
Yes. So that's Invincible Versus. And I think clearly like pivoting off of everybody loves seeing Omni-Man in Mortal Kombat, so that probably emboldened them to do this. And the other one, I don't know if this is the one that Prime Music is talking about, but there's a mobile game called Marvel Mystic Mayhem that's coming out. Oh, no, no, no. There's the She-Hulk one. That's probably what they're talking about. I'm forgetting what the name of that is, but I did watch that. That looks very fun. It has old school graphics, and it has She-Hulk doing like a Planet She-Hulk thing, a bunch of heroes behind her. So, yeah, I'm always up for it.
That's fun.
Yeah.
Michael T says, who is your top bearded hero?
Oh.
Well, let me throw this out. We could say, if we're talking MCU, you could talk about Red Guardian. You could also talk about how I saw him on the street on Sunday.
Oh, yeah? He was just chilling. What did you yell? What did you yell at him?
I didn't yell anything. I'm not that kind of guy. But
the
Red Guardian's
out there? You're not going to yell?
He was walking down Smith Street in Brooklyn.
You could put on a Russian accent and be like, Red Guardian, you're my favorite.
I'm so sorry. I just can't. I just can't do that. I know we're wearing the same shirt, but that's not what I'm going to do. He's with, like, he was talking loudly about something with a friend. With either his or his friend's kids. Like, he was having just a fun Brooklyn day. I'm going to let that man ride.
Oh, yeah. Man. I would say Greg Pak is my bearded hero.
This is great. This is so great. Last week on the show, I talked about seeing Christine Milioti on the street. This week, you saw David Harbour. We have a real, like, celeb gossip blotter thing.
We are plugged in. We're just out where the celebs are seen and being seen, you know?
Yeah.
Wow.
This is from Schoikler. I didn't get to ask last week, what are animal species guaranteed to sell comics? Is it better to have a cute animal or a dangerous one?
Well, that's an interesting question, right? Because you have Jeff, you know, Jeff is selling so great and he is definitely adorable. Yeah, okay. It's super creepy. It's a fake otter.
It's not fake.
It's not fake? It's just super still?
It's an alive otter that I've trained very well.
I know you're classically trained, but you can't train an otter to
You
be.
Can teach.
Dude, when you can knock on the side of that head. That is not moving, bro.
I would
you
never. Can't that's, me. Not, he's being very still. Okay, okay. Be free. Be free.
I can hear you knocking against wood and stuff, dude. No way.
Any other animals?
I don't know. I think Schoikler brings up a good point here. I mean, think you squirrels. Either got to go cute or dangerous. Either way, you're, you know, and Geiger, you got that two-headed wolf dog. That's a huge favorite. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Or dangerous, there are two wolves inside each of us. One is cute and one is dangerous.
It depends on which one you feed.
Stanley says, any plans to travel together again like New Orleans?
What? No way.
We're going to New Orleans again. We're going to New Orleans again.
Well, when you move down there, right, Papa Pete?
No, I want to go. I want to go for the Chewie Fest, the Chewie Parade, the Chewbacca Parade. You guys got to come down with me.
Yeah, it's Chewbacca's. It's part of the lead up to Mardi Gras. Yes, I think you should, and that's when you will move there.
Yes. Well, we do have a table at Baltimore Comic Con in October, so we'll see what happens with that. Otherwise,
exciting.
Probably travel to the Javits Center in Manhattan for the New York Comic Con.
Yep, probably do that. And of course, we'll be celebrating your 14th anniversary in January 4th, 2026.
Yeah, we're going to go to Coruscant, I believe.
Actually, I booked tickets for Gorman. Was that a bad idea?
I would see there's been a lot of revolution there. There was one. There was another one.
Yeah, but you guys were talking about spiders, so I just went ahead and booked the ticket.
Yeah, that's a great spot to squeeze a spider.
In July, hopefully I can see you guys.
Yeah, wait, cool. I am actually booked a week at your house that week when you're coming to New York, so I'll be there. Airbnb, your house.
As I've said numerous times, you guys are always welcome here. Always
again,
welcome.
You have to tell us the address to be welcomed. You can't just expect us to be like, that's a fake invite. When you're like, yeah, come to my house, I'm not telling you where it is.
You're always welcome.
I'm going to chip you and track you to your home.
Eric MCI900 says, if you were put in, I feel like this is a question specifically for you, Justin, maybe I'm wrong. If you were put in charge of reviving Marvel's new universe line from the 80s, how would you do it?
I mean, that's a line of comics that I feel like hasn't gotten a lot of love lately. Because what do we have there? We've got
Star Brand. Yeah, Star Brand's been put into the main Marvel universe. People or at least Jason Aaron loves Starbrand, and so that got jammed in there.
But it's like Justice, I'm looking this up right now, Night Mask, Psi-Force, Spitfire, and the Troubleshooter. So this is like sort of untapped situation right now.
Here's what I think they should bring back from the new universe is that ad of the Earth with a lightning bolt hitting it that ran in every single Marvel comic for like an entire year, where they're like, a new universe is coming. I was like, I don't know what this means. Cool.
Here's the only problem with a new universe. That's all comics are doing now. Like, the last thing we need is someone being like, great news. There's an incursion from a new universe coming. Buckle up. So honestly, I would have it be a slow emergence from within the Marvel universe. It feels like it's something
to just
leak out, not in New York City, but pick another city. And have these characters start to appear and do it almost Marvel Knight style and have it be like sort of come in underneath, as they say.
Yeah. Good call. And that is it for your audience questions. Next up, we are going to go over to Pete LePage for a little trivia.
All right. This is the part we give back to you, the lovely audience. It's an opportunity to win $25 free to Midtown Comics Online. So all you need to do is put in the chat, pick me, first hand up, anything like that.
Wow, Eric MCI 900, first hand up before you could even finish saying.
Got that perfect. Twitch edge. Hashtag the Twitch edge.
The Twitch edge, yeah. Twitch is getting it first, man. Everybody else is getting it second. So get on the Twitch. All right, great. Today's trivia is about the Silver Surfer and a small nod to the legend Michael Haley, RIP, the voice of the Max. Oh, God, I missed that cartoon. So good. Please listen to all three options before making your selection. Here we go. Question number one. Silver Surfer made his first appearance in what comic book in 1966? Is it A, Fantastic Four? B, Donkey Kong's Nephew, right? Used to use you in Mario Kart sometimes. Or C, Diddy Kong.
Wow. The Max cartoon was something that one of the first times in college when I did mushrooms, someone was like, let's put on the Max. I was like, no, no, that's the last thing we should put.
Yeah, dude, that's already tripped out.
A?
A is correct. Here we go. Question number two. Who created Silver Surfer? Is it A, T-1000, B, Jack Kirby, or C, Lorenzo Lamas?
Ooh,
tough call. Tough
call.
Wait,
did you just... are there actually two options here?
Not really, no.
Okay, great. A three, I guess Lorenzo Lamas, creative person.
Yeah.
Man, it would Lorenzo.
It would be some impressive range.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, well, yes?
No, go ahead.
Stray Bullet has an audience question. Would Pete ever do a nod to a legend that is still alive?
Ooh, that's a great idea.
A living legend.
Yeah.
I don't think so. Eric MCI says, I want to say the Renegade, but Kirby, final answer.
Oh, nice shout out. Yes, Kirby is correct.
Nice.
And then we go question number three here, last one. Is Silver Surfer's alter ego's name? Is it A, Norn Red, B, Can't Keep Your Pants On, Remember You, C, John Mooney?
Here's the thing.
Yeah.
John Mooney is just as good as Norn Red.
You think so?
Yeah, just as a name, from a name. Makes a lot of sense from a space name, John Mooney.
Mm. Okay, I see what you're saying there, yeah.
I have another question, actually, from the audience here. Would you ever consider making this trivia?
Show me who said that. Yeah, because...
It's one of the secret comments.
Secret comments.
Yeah, it's on Kick. It's on Kick. Something we don't...
Yeah. Eric MCI says, I like to portmanteau and say NORAD.
NORAD.
Yeah, NORAD. Well done. And Scheuchler is correct as well. We're talking about the 1978 classic, Grease.
Wow.
Nice.
There we go. All right. Congratulations, Eric. You're going to get a gift card to Midtown Comics. Shoot us an email. We'll get that to you. And why don't...
Shoikes.
We talked about what's coming out tomorrow. What are you looking forward to that is coming in stores, Pete?
Oh, man, there's so much great stuff I'm looking forward to. Death of Silver Surfer, number one, the whole reason I'm doing this nod. DC and Vampires, World War V, number 10. And Absolute Batman, number 9.
All right, there we go. No explanation necessary. Justin, what about
just
you?
Just words and numbers from our guy, Pete LePage.
That's right. That way I don't get yelled at by Alex for saying too much.
That's not what he's actually yelling at you for, the opposite thing, by saying too little.
Yeah, well, either way, I get yelled at.
Speak, Pete. Oh, yelled at. I get yelled at all the time by Alex, my friend.
I loved it when I was one and my mommy yelled at me.
I want to be a baby again, famously, is what Pete says. I'm very curious about the new Avengers number one. Lineup of this comic looks interesting to me. And, you know, the Avengers feels very, a lot's happening with the Doom stuff. Feels like this maybe is a new, different take. So that could be fun to get into. Also excited for a little something that I like to call a comic called Stalling Number 6. No, Magic Number 6. It's been one of my favorite X books that's been going on. So let's go. Let's see what's happening next. This is kicking off a new arc, I believe, because the last issue ended the last arc. Excited for it.
I'm looking forward to Lost Fantasy number 2 from Image Comics, written by Kurt Pyers, the artist by Luca Casalanguida. The first issue was this huge, oversized, like Final Fantasy-inspired adventure, followed by a follow-up to their Indigo Children story. So really excited to see whatever they have cooked up for the second issue. Also, the Umbrella Academy Plan B number 1 is coming out tomorrow from Dark Horse.
Come on.
After maybe 5 years, something like that, I want to say.
Been a while.
So,
crazy well, they were doing the TV back. Show for a while,
Well, no, I think they were just drawing it pretty big shoe. And those reviews and lots of other reviews are going to be in our Stack podcast, the TPU's Wednesday, 9 a.m., and the Stack feed and the Comic Book Club feed. And folks, that is it for this week's shoe. Couple of people we want to thank.
Toxic Team Up, Derek.
New tradition. Right. New tradition.
Yes. Connor McCurry for talking about The Last Witch, Blood and Betrayal, number one. That's coming out June 18th. Scott Brian Wilson, The Left Hand Path. You can get that from Dead Sky Publishing. Next week on the show, we're going to have a big packed one. Margaret Stoll, Judith Stevens, and Janine Schaefer are going to be here to talk about their new book, Super Visible, The Story of the Women of Marvel Comics. And also, Murwa Yodale is going to be here to talk about Storm.
All right. Yes. We love Storm.
Do that.
Thunder Wars is coming, and we're going to be chatting about that, so that's very exciting as well. Comic Book Club News, our daily news podcast every day of the week. Check that out. You can support this show and all the shows we do at patreon.com/comicbookclub. You can check us out at comicbookclublive.com for this podcast and many more. Until next time, we'll see you at the Comic Book Club.
Yeah.
Woo! Click to subscribe. I'm real. I'm real.
As a blink once.
I'm real, neither of you.
Thanks, everybody.
Shouts out to Jasper.
Is this one real, Pete? Is this one real?
Oh, that's real.
Have a good night, everybody.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.